This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back after lunch for our the second half of the day and the and our symposium address. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you today and to have with us today and for the symposium Dr. Charles Merriweather. And Charles Merriweather is an art historian and a curator, as most of us know. We've been having a chance to chat with him over the past day and a half. He's currently a research fellow at the Institute of Advanced Studies at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. In 2007-2008, he was the deputy director of the cultural district of Saadiyat Island for the Tourism Development and Investment Company in Abu Dhabi, and previously arts and culture consultant for the Emirates Foundation in the UAE. He is also chairman of the advisory board of the Hong Kong International Art Fair. Charles was the artistic director and curator of the Biennale of Sydney in 2006, the collections curator at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, and the inaugural curator of the Museo Arte Contemporaneo de Monterrey in Mexico. He has taught at the University of Sydney, the Universidad Autónoma Barcelona, the Ibero Americana, Mexico City, and the University of Southern California. He has been the recipient of various fellowships from institutions including Yale University and Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Cross-Cultural Research, Australian National University, from 2004 to 2007. Merriweather has published widely on modernism and contemporary art in Europe and the Americas, Australia, and East Asia. His most recent books are Ai Weiwei, Under Construction. He was the editor and contributor to Art, Anti-Art, Non-Art, Experimentations in the Public Sphere in Post-War Japan from 1950 to 1970. And he was the editor of The Archive in 2006. He is currently writing a book on the cultural history of looting, and today we'll be giving a talk on art history in the public sphere. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Charles Merriweather.
Thank you very much, Brenda, for a kind introduction. And thank you both, Brenda and Vinita, for having me here today. It's a pleasure to be here these 2 days, I think especially in your company, because one begins to see the outline, if not the lineaments, of a new art history, ways of thinking about a subject which often is very familiar to us, but remains to be challenged in terms of certain orthodoxies. And it occurred to me that in giving a presentation today, two things occurred to me. The first was the relationship of what you're practicing as art historians and the, if I may say, the wider public sphere in terms of your place within the public sphere. We often think of the practice of art history within the academy. And, of course, there are those beyond us who call us, they're just academician, or they're in the university, as a way of discounting them, discounting their point of view, or in a way curtailing their influence. For me, having done my doctorate in art history, there's no easy way to put in my resume that art history is the basis on which really I worked and moved towards the museum as distinct from remaining within the university. But I think for a long time it struck me that it was terribly important to bring what we knew and what we were wishing to learn and convey to an audience and to a wider public, that which we'd learnt. How do we translate that in a manner that goes beyond the confines, if I may say, the confines of ourselves? And for that reason, I have chosen and sought to choose over the past several years to alternate between the academy and the museum as different places but linked, necessarily, I think, and importantly linked in terms of our practice. So today, I was going to speak, and I confess, I think, that in some ways I was going to give another lecture, but at the same time, I also thought that there may be some value, I hope there will be, some value of relating my experience of having worked in Abu Dhabi. My experience of having worked in Abu Dhabi, and I say this by way of reference to what I've just said, as an art historian. My museum experience certainly I brought to bear, but I think fundamentally, in terms of the sorts of approaches that I carried with me and my concerns, it was as an art historian. And it may well be, although I could almost say it was also my undoing insofar as deciding to resign. So I thought that this is not meant to be a lecture as a kind of moral tale, but nonetheless, there is a kind of tale to be told here, I think, about the constraints of art historians working in the public sphere, which makes me all the more adamant that it's necessary. So I'm going to speak about that experience of working on Saadiyat Island, which is in Abu Dhabi, which is the capital, for those who don't know, the capital of the United Arab Emirates. The Emirates are made up of seven Emirate states, and they're formed into a nation in 1971. So very recent. And let me, what am I looking for? Oh, this. Let me, I'm sorry, it's a little small, but you'll get the gist of it for our undertaking this afternoon, which is the United Arab Emirates are here, Saudi immediately to her left, and in fact, if it wasn't for the British, I must say, if it wasn't for the British and the determination of the British, in collaboration with some of the leaders of the different Emirates in this period, 69 and 70, 71, this would now be Saudi Arabia. But the seven Emirates formed very small here, and here you see the Gulf, and then down here you go into Oman, etc. Up here is Bahrain, up here Kuwait and Iraq, and then the Middle East. I show it to you, and it will become, I think, important as we move on through the lecture. Now, just to bring us closer, here's Dubai. As you probably all know, Abu Dhabi is here, and Saudi over there, there's Qatar, which also has a very strong museum culture developing there. And then just to get further, this is Saadiyat Island here, as marked. This is a narrow stretch of water here, and bridges are being built over here and across here. And this is the main city here. Now there's a lot of, as you can see, reclaimed land going on. This is Saadiyat Island as it was about a year ago, before they brought in about, can't remember the exact figure, it's tens of thousands of Indian and Pakistani workers who were brought in to level the ground and begin to place the infrastructure in for the building of the island and of the cultural district. this is what you've just seen, two slides, here we are. And here is the cultural district is here, and you'll see, and we'll get closer to it, but this is an early rendering of the principal sites, if you will, museum sites, and this is the Geary, the Guggenheim here, this is the Jean Nouvel Louvre, Abu Dhabi, This is Zaha Hadid's performing art space, etc. All of this over here will be developed in terms of hotels and resort area. Here is a wetlands area. Here is urban development, and here further urban development. And now, quite recently, New York University is going to have a campus which is still under debate as to its location. It may well be in this residential area rather than the cultural district. Here's a better map, and you can see this is an initial idea of placement for the museums, but we can talk about that. So let me begin. I'll leave that on for the moment. The plans for the cultural district encompassed a series of stages that would unfold over the course of several years, beginning with the opening of the Sheikh Zayed National Museum in 2012, designed by Foster and Partner, and the Louvre Abu Dhabi and Guggenheim Abu Dhabi.
Since this map, which is about 2.5 years old, the National Museum will be placed here directly opposite the foreshore. This may be moved for reasons of competitiveness, frankly, and this will become a kind of promenade down from the Sheikh Zayed. So the Sheikh Zayed National Museum, Sheikh Zayed was the founder of the nation, will become an axis which opens up in the different directions.
These museums, the Louvre, Guggenheim, and Sheikh Zayed National Museum, were the initial centerpieces to the cultural district and part of a larger master plan for Sadiat Island, composed of beach resorts, golf links, existing wetland, and residential area. The cultural district would contain non-commercial and commercial cultural institutions, residencies, community schools, and a commercial business sector to service the district. Opening gradually, the cultural district was seen as a series of stages that also included other museums, as I noted before, but also more recently, prior to my departure, a science and technology museum, a maritime museum, and possibly a military museum. My optimistic dream for the cultural district of Sadiat Island was to contribute in developing an environment in which the creative arts could be fostered and given a home. This home would be a place where the creative arts were critically appreciated and serve as a platform for valuing the cultural heritage of a country and people alongside an intercultural dialogue with others. Such a dialogue would provide a means of sharing knowledge and appreciation for one another's cultures and the often shared histories as well as differences they embody. I saw this as a model for what globalization could possibly offer insofar as encouraging countries, institutions, and individuals to exchange, collaborate, and share their cultural and intellectual wealth as much as their knowledge and expertise. With all of that said, I believe this could be viewed as a worthy aspiration, especially in the light of decreasing resources for the arts and humanities, as well as the sharing of riches of some cultures whose institutions have built extraordinary collections and bodies of expertise, but fail in terms of their funding to be able to support it sufficiently well for its public. And here in particular, I'm referring to places like Egypt and the great museum collections there. For me, the project represented in concept the development of a civic space that provided the means by which communities of the UAE could experience and engage with the cultural and artistic histories both from the region and internationally. In a society where there's tremendous economic growth and initiative, the opportunity of the Sadiat project was to foster creativity and appreciation of the arts and the humanities without being determined by the market forces and interests. Such projects would then, I hoped, encourage and promote the development of a non-governmental sector in the arts that belongs to the public sphere and was economically sustainable. This would be, in our own terms, a civic society in which the public intellectual and those committed to education, creativity, and experimentation in the arts and culture find a sense of belonging within a collective present and place in which to contribute to its well-being and future. So then one has to ask, with all this passion for the introduction and development of a globalized Abu Dhabi, where does nationalism lie? There's no doubt that this is also a nation-building project concerning the sustainability of the country. Both the Saadiyat project and that of Masdar City in Abu Dhabi, which is to build a planned carbon-neutral environment and the development of renewable energy resource, are principal examples of nation-building endeavours. Such projects serve to demonstrate the state as strong, with a clear vision and ability to implement that vision. Sustainability means, in this context, the need for massive investment in generating projects that enhance production, wealth, and workforce in the future, as well as protect the environment and peoples. And it's around this point that it becomes more complex, because on the one hand, there's a felt need to protect a heritage and Muslim values, while on the other hand, to enable the UAE to have access to and become part of a larger global information technology, net economy and culture. This indeed is a delicate balancing act, requiring a high degree of tolerance, respect and understanding. But it also means scrutinising what is meant by cultural heritage, that is not something fixed in the past or to the past or an object per se, but rather alive, evolving with time and generations. Moreover, heritage is to be found between peoples who may be of different ethnicities and races, countries and epochs. What seems critical to this recognition is the internal dynamic of its articulation, in which issues concerning the values of cultural heritage and tradition, or of modernism and the metropolitan or global technologies, are critical terms of ongoing debate and articulation by forces of both resistance and change. At the same time, what became equally clear was the sense of the West being haunted, if not possessed, by the legacy of its political and cultural history, i.e. colonialism, as much as its ongoing aspiration to sustain itself as a global power. Hence the continuing use of terms such as international, universal, even global, or similarly the other, oriental, local, and the model, as I will demonstrate, the model of the tabula rasa, in which there was no culture to be found, masking a sustained hegemonic position as regard Western cultural centres. Where's my tea? Sorry. Oh, there. Within these terms, these issues can be seen as played out by certain producers who, by internalising Western perspectives, aestheticised, if not exoticised, local traditions and hence revalorised the conditions of marginalisation or colonial otherness. The most obvious example has been the contemporary relation to the complex history and heritage of Orientalism. Complex because reclaiming the work and the sense of control over the way they themselves were portrayed. In the introduction to a small catalogue called Orientalism, A Tribute to Arabia, which was produced in London by the Mathaf Gallery, the author argues for a benign innocence about the subject, about empire, legacy in the Orient, and I quote, rather about this catalogue and the work that is being shown is about how the work provides access to the cultural past of the Emirati as distinct from full of stereotypes of the Oriental as a type, the sexualized image of women. In other words, what's being argued in such brevity, in a sense, is that the Orientalist work, in fact, provides information, if not knowledge, to the local Emirati about themselves and about a history which they are suggesting has been lost otherwise. On the other hand, responses by Western institutions and media to the Saadiyat project reveals a deeply held concept of progress as conceived in the age of enlightenment and modernization. What they exposed was the historically inherited fault lines and contemporary fracture within the European project of self-definition, as it evident in, for example, even most recently in the reformation of the European Union. And as such, the dynamics and dominant tropes of modernity through which racism and the construction of otherness is produced, continues to be produced. What is at work in such marketing is a selling back of exoticism, now concealed by virtue of an appeal to the formal aesthetic of the Orientalist work and the notion of a shared history and a universalist idea of a shared humanity. Similarly, these debates recognise, too, the way in which the Western cultural producers seek to accommodate the local by incorporating motifs or forms that they perceive to stand in for the cultural traditions and values, deferring to what they perceive as their values. Both these positions serve only to produce a culture in stasis, as opposed to one open and defined within a dynamic of change and continuity. Alternatively, Jean Keller, who is a critic and former director of the Picasso Museum in Paris, responded to the Abu Dhabi project as being predominantly concerned with the nouveau riche and their use of wealth to buy cultural capital. From this perspective, the Louvre and the Western museums should not be for sale, argued Claire. Art is not merchandise. It is not a consumer good to be bought and sold. This is a long article that he wrote in Le Monde called Museums Not for Sale, which has been subsequently made into a book devoted to the Abu Dhabi, to a critique of the Abu Dhabi project. The view of Clare and other authors who have collaborated with him is that such projects were only about petrodollars and military relations, and the Emiratis won't be able to take care of the fragile work, let alone come to look at it. They will instead want to be playing golf and lying on the beach. The former president of the Sorbonne, Jean-Robert Pitt, was cited in Newsweek as remarking, and I quote, "Can we really bring culture to camel riders and carpet sellers? They want the Louvre, the Sorbonne, and the Guggenheim like their ladies want handbags from Christian Dior." The crudity of this racist perspective, or accusation of the Emirates as a tabula rasa by Western and other commentators, is made out of a willful ignorance exacerbated by those in the Emirates who espouse heritage talk without a willingness to engage or to critically engage with their own history. A more benign, though equally problematic, response was captured in an address to the Abu Dhabi leadership and to the international press by the president of New York University, who had trained as a theologian. So you understand his remark when he said that it was the time now in this century of the other to give back. The vision of the leadership that brought me on board was their expressed belief in providing Abu Dhabi with a world-class range of cultural and educational facilities that would benefit the Emirati and the people of Abu Dhabi and the UAE. Hence, while it can be seen as a tremendous accomplishment to have secured and made possible the iconic architectural buildings of Nivelle, Foster and Geary, it's quite another matter to develop the conceptual framework and substance of what will go inside and around them. And let me show you now. And you would have seen, maybe I'll come back to that. This is the Performing Arts Center by Zaha Hadid, as designed by her. But very quickly, we raised issues concerning how on earth this will be work acoustically, given it was a performing arts centre. And I suspect that this will be the last you'll see of her in Abu Dhabi. I think that probably, certainly at the time I was leaving, it was muted that there'd be another architectural firm brought on. This is the Maritime Museum designed by Tadeo Ando. And in fact, it extends down, you can go beneath the water, and then it becomes
It's completely glass on one side, and you're able to, in fact, see the marine life. It's actually a very beautiful and economic design. This is also a path that you can walk out on. Oh, bad slide. Sorry, this is the Geary. Oh. It probably looks better in blur, but I won't say, I won't make any judgments. But this is Geary. It is a kind of signature style, gone a little bit wild in his later life, throwing everything together. It represents about 30 plus thousand square meters, so it's enormous, but technically very problematic, in part because there's an awful lot of space in between to be able to make these different sort of forms work together. This is the Jean Nouvel, the Louvre Abu Dhabi, and this underneath, as you can see, really is the infrastructure in terms of the interior building for the different exhibition spaces. I think there's a side one, yeah. And this bad slide of a kind of interior, but this is the effect of the roof. I don't have a lot of images. I really want to attend to the subject rather than to at hand rather than the architecture. In developing these museums, certainly these first three, and at the time there wasn't a model that I could take a photo of the National Museum, so you'll have to bear with that absence of. The leadership understood the need for a means of by which to train and professionalise, in particular, the Emirati workforce in culture and the arts education. This was seen as part of a long-term plan, providing an essential component in the growth of a knowledge-based economy, a term that was much used a few years ago, particularly in terms of that region, and in developing an advanced research opportunity for future generations of the Emirati in particular. Hence, the ability of the country to provide cultural and educational institutions of an international standard of excellence became a symbol of the country's progress and security in delivering services and investment opportunities, and hence also an ability to participate at the global level. And that's the result of which is something like New York and the Sorbonne participating in the Abu Dhabi project. At one time, Yale University came and it seemed as if Yale would assume the mantle of offering courses in a range of seven disciplines, but that fell through for a number of reasons, and New York University took its place. However, what remained a huge challenge was in planning a cultural district that had not organically developed over a long period of time, as we're so used to. For while one can argue against an organicist cultural notion and the implicit idea of progress that underwrites it, one has to ask what is an alternative model? How would it work? How can one put the process of perception and learning on fast track? And if so, what steps need to be taken? What goes first in order for it to be achieved? This indeed was one of the principal challenges that we had to face. Furthermore, what is the point of view that sufficiently allows for recognition of different cultures to embody distinct, if not opposing, beliefs as much as shared values and aspirations, hence forms of exchange? Does the shock of the new work best? Perhaps not. But then, does one present other histories in their own right or rethink them interculturally, all from a perspective that claims a universalism, let alone globalism? Yet even universalism has a point of view disguised as it might be otherwise, and I'll come back to that in relation to the Louvre. So it means returning to the local as the perspective from which to begin, or to serve as a point of reference by virtue
of pertaining to the local audience. What precisely is the local, then, in this instance of the UAE? And moreover, is it only the Emirati, or is it not now, today, multi-layered, multi-ethnic, multicultural, though distinguished by racial discrimination and economic sustainability, with different levels of education and degrees of access, knowledge, and open engagement with other cultures? Perhaps Islamic culture could be taken as a starting point, and I say perhaps there, by which to build a program or museum that, like a souk, has a central spine along which the story can be told, but it has two passages and alleyways branching off that provide the connections, exchanges, and in turn lead to other points of access with their own branches, etc. A maze or labyrinth indeed, but who has such collections? And what does one do with fields of interpretive dispute, such as the period of the Crusades, or when the origin of a work lies precisely within the field of exchange, such as those of fetish objects that, as referred to, emerged in the trade between Portuguese and West Africans, or even the uneven development of modernism? Moreover, is not the field of creativity far more serendipitous and less about the story of influences than the aesthetic achievement that embodies a complex set of values? How does one approach the building of a historically nuanced program that both enables people to appreciate the critical importance of aesthetic experimentation and innovation, whilst at the same time providing a historical framework for its reception? And how does one develop such a perspective within a short span of time when there is an absence of preparation on the ground? Both the Louvre and the Guggenheim projects have come under considerable scrutiny and sweeping criticism, as we saw from those remarks of Claire. But there is some point to it, in part because they are seen as motivated by the need to support their own public institutions or as forms of government of soft power in regard to geopolitical relations. At the same time, this dream has been roundly criticised by some of the Western world's most respected museum leaders, such as Montebello, formerly and most recently, of course, of the Metropolitan. And his complaint was sending art to countries where the heritage makes no sense and where to lend into the emptiness becomes an abuse of art. End of quote. However, I did believe the potential of each constituted a significant step from any previous historical model, whether during the period of imperial and colonial expansion or under the aegis of Western modernity. What differed about each was that, on the one hand, the Louvre project involved a consortium of different French museums and collections, as well as a dedicated organisation to help develop the project. And on the other hand, a Guggenheim museum that was only part of a larger complex of cultural institutions, that is, unlike the Guggenheim Bilbao. Not only should they be seen as a step in recognition of mutual needs, but a fundamental belief in the value of public culture and of public cultural institutions that serve in the movement towards cultural emancipation. Ironically, contrary to the criticism of the endeavours taking place in the Emirates, these projects reaffirm the continuing value of the museum as a public and relatively autonomous sphere. It's this sphere, when faced by the diminishing support of government funding, becomes increasingly important to support. From within this context, it seems to me too, however delicate it may be, that there's an extraordinary opportunity for Abu Dhabi and the Emirates to establish a framework that enables and shapes a critical relation to, but is still entwined with, that of the Middle East and its region in terms of history and contemporary culture. By region, I would especially refer also to the subcontinent and its long historical role in the development of the Gulf states. Not that one would recognise it now. In fact, the subcontinent was tremendously instrumental in making the Emirates what it is today, but now has seen very much in terms of simply providing a kind of workforce, an itinerant, if not short-term, workforce. Equally important is the recognition of the extraordinary wealth that characterises the cultural histories and contemporary practices of the Middle East. that while radically distinct from the Gulf, and this is very important, are nonetheless imperative to address. And there are often people who will talk about the Gulf in terms of being the Middle East. But let me say, if you've been to both, you'll understand how radically different they are in every sense of the word. In short, one must acknowledge the kind of radically different historical trajectories these countries have taken, especially over the past 100 years or so, with the end of colonialism and the different forms and stages of modernization undertaken and accomplished. There's no unifying thread here, and the cultural practices that characterize each of these countries within the larger sphere have taken on their own particular character and significance, as well as differing relations between themselves and with the Western world. And yet none of this should be sufficient to deny that the opportunity is here to be taken, most especially given the Emirates population is composed also of large communities from the Arab world and from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. This raises the issue of creating audiences across a hugely diverse public and providing educational opportunities in such a way as to benefit all of them and the country in which they live. This, of course, is yet to be obtained, and in fact it's barely gotten to step one. Recently, the ambassador for Pakistan to the UAE spoke out severely criticizing the government for its failure to be able to ride anything more than simply a work and a place to sleep for the Pakistani community. And I would imagine that's been likewise supported by the governments of India and Sri Lanka, Bangladesh. Moreover, this perspective is also due to the long history of entwinement that I mentioned with the Gulf states, especially when understood more broadly in terms of the Persian or Arab Gulf, and here I mean, of course, Kuwait, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Oman, and the UAE. But precisely because also of the current climate, in which there's an increasing crisis over the Western military presence, armed conflict and foreign occupation, energy resources, nuclear armament, the rise of radical Islam, and the destruction of cultures and their histories, as well as the ongoing displacement of peoples from their homeland and the enduring refugee crisis. To this end, then, it can be argued that the tremendous potential to be found in the kind of platform the Emirates could provide to the Middle East and the region as much as for themselves. A sense of cooperation and mutual recognition would also assist in overcoming the prejudices and oft-times racism that exists between these countries and communities, in fact. The opportunity, then, is not simply one of identifying or serving diverse audiences, but of collaboratively exploring together with them their distinct and shared cultural histories and the overcoming of these social distinctions that currently prevailed across and between the Emirates. At an institutional level, the cultural fabric that exists in Abu Dhabi is important here to mention. We have there in Abu Dhabi the Cultural Foundation, which offers a tremendous program of events, as well as hosted by government agencies such as the British Council, the Goethe Society, Alliance Française, as much as Zayed University, and now the Sorbonne. There are other organizations too, and such events as the Abu Dhabi Music and Arts Festival, the Abu Dhabi Book Fair, and most recently the arrival of an independent newspaper, The National, which is based really on the New York Times, seeking to offer a serious cultural section in its daily. You've got to remember that, in fact, until the National, there was no real dedicated space to culture, neither in a historical sense or a contemporary sense. There were middle pages which were about how to spend a weekend with your kids doing art, and the occasional exhibition review somewhere near the sports page. But over and above that, neither in Arabic nor in English was there any critical platform or review platform for the activities that were taking place, however minuscule they may have been. All of these organizations and initiatives are, to a lesser or greater degree, ones which offer also a degree of quality in terms of they provide a basis and a platform for critical exchange of the creative arts. But then the question of what counts, what's quality really, insofar as it matters, who decides and on what basis can benchmarks be established? Questions that remain to be thought through and answered. It's neither enough to say leave it to the Westerners, but nor is it enough to simply say leave it to the locals to decide. The critical issue that confronts us today is knowledge of one another, of what's being offered and why. Now, the first two shows, as an example, that were shown in Abu Dhabi at the Emirates Palace, which is in fact, frankly, a glorified hotel, an exclusive hotel, extremely expensive one, which only really caters to a small community of people. The first two shows were shown there for lack of any other space. So we transformed part of it, offered part of it, transformed it into an exhibition-style space to show the first exhibition, which was the Khalili collection. Khalili had formed this massive collection of several thousand pieces pertaining to the cultural history of Islam. And we showed it. It was well received and certainly well viewed in terms of the audience, but one could sense that while some of the material that was shown indeed demonstrate the intercultural relationship, particularly between parts of Islamic communities in Pakistan and in India and in other parts of the world, it showed this exchange and dialogue, and a very fertile one at that. The limit in terms of the audience was tremendous, so that no one really who didn't look the part would be able to go there and go and see the exhibition, nor did the greater community of those who work in Abu Dhabi in terms of labour force, nor did they ever think of going. I mean, this was not an area that they ever thought of going to. It just was not their area. It was a place where they worked in as a taxi driver. They would drop someone off. And of course, the majority of, for those who've been there, though, you'll know immediately the majority of taxi drivers are, in fact, from Kerala. And Kerala has profited an enormous community of people working throughout the Emirates. But it was not, the Emirates Palace was not, or Emirates Hotel was not a place that they felt easy about going to. And so this rich cultural heritage and exchange that was provided through viewing the Khalili collection was in fact only available to a small sector of the public. And one feared, in a sense, that this was perhaps the beginning of something that was going to continue. And certainly my own experience of working there, that was something that was not on the agenda. It was something that may come up later. But the principal agenda, really, was to get the buildings built. Don't worry too much about who's going to go and see it. Presumption being, of course, that the wealthy middle and upper class Emiratis would be the principal audience. There was then a Picasso show, and oh, the other thing too, of course, was even more closely tuned would be that the Khalili collection and Khalili himself, I think, making the determination, downplayed the importance of Persian culture in terms of the sort of cultural heritage, cultural richness they had contributed to Islamic culture. The second exhibition was a retrospective of Picasso, which was drawn from the Picasso Museum, and it was extremely interesting to see. It was about 150, 60 works drawn from actually from a show that went to the Reina Sofia last year in May, of some 380 works, I think. And it was chosen by the curator of the Picasso Museum in Paris in consultation with a cultural advisor and a person from the leadership. Neither of them knew too much about Picasso except that there were nudes. And so they went to Madrid and walked through and made a selection in which some rather tame nudes, if you will, were permitted in, and they arrived at this figure of 160, 50-odd. I later went, this was just prior to my departure, and it, in a small sense, confirmed my worst fears. I went later, having seen the Abu Dhabi show, to realize that they'd chosen a second-rate show. But the hands were tied, and we paid some $6 million, I think, to take this show. I guess any Picasso show is better than none, but I wasn't of that opinion. One might add, or pause here too, whether in fact Picasso was the right choice in the context of Abu Dhabi and the UAE. Is it personality that counts? Because marketing has become a more powerful tool than the understanding of the history of art. Perhaps Manet, Cézanne, Duchamp, even Malevich would have taught us more not only about the great art of the Western modern era, but equally of how each of these artists were innovative exponents of modern art at different moments during the course of its development. In the context of a building program, schedule and deadline, these kinds of questions can be swiftly consigned as being overly academic or peripheral to the immediate tasks to be done, and therefore given neither time nor place in which they may be conducted. This is precisely the challenge of such a timetable that's determined by the end date of delivery, indeed only 5 years away. Institutions such as the British Museum, the Metropolitan, or those of Dusseldorf and Berlin, amongst others, do not have such pressure and have great collections and a staff of immense learning and competence with which to begin these sorts of projects. This involves a complex of perspectives representing very different cultural values and interests, and hence collaboration that should lie at the very heart of the project. Few Western cultural institutions with which Abu Dhabi or the Arab world could work have been faced with these kinds of questions insofar as their programming in order to curate their own audiences. To address these issues for a local audience is then a different and radically new enterprise. Moreover, by producing exhibitions and programming, even on the modern and contemporary, will not ease the burden. There are few scholars there who have done the kind of homework that is needed to be able to provide the basis of a framework. The deconstruction and re-elaboration of modernity is still in its infancy as regards these countries. There are beginnings from the West in looking at the influence of the larger Mediterranean, such as North Africa, on Western artists, but this is still far from the Gulf. And yet again, this is only one side of a story to be told. So let me just conclude by returning back to the Guggenheim and the Louvre, because one of my jobs was, in fact, was to address not only in terms of the building structure and the greater cultural district and how it would look, whether this should be a narrow road or a wide road, whether this should be placed here or in association with that museum or that centre. It was also to talk about the programmes of each. And what was striking was that the Louvre, on the one hand, had made the proposal to build, and this is maybe 3.5 years ago, had made the proposal to build a classical museum. And over the course of its development in terms of this, and for a number of reasons, which I think were larger than just cultural, because we know now, of course, the ambitions of the French to have a base there, a military base there. that they began to see themselves, and the Louvre as being certainly, you know, a government cultural institution, they began to see themselves in broader and larger strategic terms, and proposed a universal museum, which was extremely interesting insofar, of course, the Louvre itself was founded on this notion of universal museum in the period really following the Enlightenment, or of the time of the Enlightenment, and to propose it again in the 21st century was indeed an intellectual challenge, to think that a one country had the resources in its various collections throughout, in this case, of course, France, had the collection to be able to provide and even be able to offer some kind of reading which is universal. I think it's something that, you know, we talk about the global, and it, I think there are lots of reasons why now we need to, but it doesn't make the task any easier in terms of what we mean by, you know, writing a global art history. How do we begin to develop a kind of comparative basis on which to construct that history? How even do we start to talk about history? And of course, cultural historians, anthropologists and others have tackled this for some years, and art history is still, I think, very much at the front entrance, if you will, of trying to address this. The Guggenheim, on the other hand, proposed a international collection and exhibition program. And it's no secret to tell you that we gave them initially $600 million to build an initial collection. And it was interesting to see it. I'll never forget when I received the document, you know, document M, or, you know, document 21, which was the list of works that Tom Krenz, in fact, to say Guggenheim would be too generous, Tom Krenz wanted to buy, and it spoke, you know, it spoke loud and clear as to, you know, the agenda. What was the? There was no preface. There was no introduction. There was no conclusion. There was no narrative, except that which was, you know, between, if you will, the listing of the work, so that, you know, you would go from, I guess, Sol LeWitt to Carl Andre, and we all know what that there's the, you know, the beginnings of a sort of narrative, and you add, you know, Richard Serra, Carl Andre, Sol LeWitt, and you begin to understand very clearly the narrative there. And it began in that way, artists, American artists from the 50s and 60s, and then ended up in I think about five pages, fairly bold type, you know, 14 point, ended up with some artists from the Middle East. No artists from the Gulf, artists from the Middle East, you know, Shireen Nashrat and other names that we know of that have done, I must say, very well in the West, and it's good to see, but they were included in the last six pages. But suddenly, you know, the sense of a narrative and of a logic in terms of the aesthetics, in terms of the how in which we might begin even to write an art history, was, I think, lost on me and lost on those who at all were interested. But this was the international, and international is a term, of course, which was used in the 60s, I think, to great effect insofar as international was used as a way of signifying the kind of extraordinary artistic exchange that happened throughout the world in a manner that, you know, I think often contemporary commentators forget, you know, that this, we've already been around the block once on this. But their international, or Tom Krenn's notion of the international, was simply a way, a descriptive manner of saying, you know, there'd be artists from different parts of the world. But there was no, let's say, art historical understanding, no proposition here in terms of, you know, breaking an orthodox or dominant model in terms of the way in which we can look at, let's say, the history of the present, history of the present, if you will, going from World War II. So international actually, veiled, it seemed to me, veiled a very strong ideological position, which for those of us who have followed the franchise of the Guggenheim understand very well. So this in fact became, in many of the meetings, we'd have these absurd meetings in which we'd fly to Paris for one day and fly back and go back to work. It sounds exotic, but it honestly is not exotic at all, let me assure you. And we'd sit in these meetings, and there'd be maybe two of us and there'd be 20 of them. They would put forth their propositions. But eventually the sorts of discussions that we wanted to have about, well, how do you, yes, okay, we're going to build these museums and we have these stars and they're going to attract an audience. But let's, okay, that's stage one. We all accept that and that's underway. Contracts have been signed, et cetera. But stage two, which should overlap with stage one, is, but how are you going to build the infrastructure of a museum with which to tell another story about the history of art? And who knows this history of art? Do you people there at this meeting know this, and what are you proposing? Hence my example, when, if you take any particular moment in the history of art, and as I suggested, if you even take the Crusades, how is the story of the Crusades through the work of art going to be told in a way which breaks the traditional dominant reading of the Crusades? What work are you going to bring? What work from any one of your collections in France are going to break that, are going to offer another way of viewing it? And why, even worse, of course, how, in fact, are you going to be able to develop an art history which accommodates, if I say naturally accommodates for the kind of work that's going on now in the UAE? I'm on the jury of the Victoria and Albert Museum for a prize to a contemporary artist whose work in some way demonstrates the traditions of Islamic calligraphy. And it's extremely interesting to see that, of course, half the artists are breaking with it. It's not to say that there's not a point of reference, but they're breaking with it. And it's interesting to kind of follow, and understand their way of working, their relationship to such a strong tradition, and their less than orthodox practice. But these sorts of issues which I think, art historians are best equipped to be able to address, were the sorts of issues that finally, at the end of the day, were put on the back burner. And it's these sorts of issues, I think, that are terribly important for all of us to address. And I think, too, and hence, in a sense, my title, and I've given you some, I guess, a sort of description of what it means to be confronted by in a number of worlds which really not understanding and appreciating one another. Just to close, this, I have to remind ourselves that many of these projects are developed, in a sense, commercially. They're developed by, architects, construction companies, and generally by people working in the field of construction. They have no interest in art history. And the Louvre wants to demonstrate its power and its global power, its global reach, as part of the general, I think, French national effort to assume a role within this region, and using the Emirates as a sort of point, slightly outside of the Middle East, strategic point, as much as the Guggenheim in terms of its franchise. So it was a very complex situation. And as I say, as an art historian, an absolutely fascinating, if not overwhelming, challenge, which unfortunately I had to leave, because in a sense it seemed to me that what was at stake was the survival within that particular moment and microcosm, the survival of the practice of art history. So thank you.
This was fascinating. How can you rewrite this art history? I'm wondering. You asked the question. How can we, rewrite this art history and locate it? Like for instance, the Crusades, a perfect example. How do we do this? And I'm wondering. You're working on a project now on the politics of looting. I understand.
Supposedly, it's a cultural history of looting. Yeah.
Is that a mode of getting at some of these issues?
Yeah.
Do you see it as?
It is a mode.
And is that, I would imagine it is.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
I wish I could. I struggle with even this project which I've set myself. It pertains really to your point. Another way to getting to the issue of value. It happened because of the first US invasion to Iraq. Let me note which one. And I was working on China in the early photography in China. At the same time, and around 1860, and the period in which the Summer Palace was stormed and put under fire and destroyed, and a great deal of objects, precious objects, were lost or looted. And that was the initial, and it struck me that there was a larger story to be told, different instances, but different values at work, and how did value, transmigrate, for example, and what was lost, and even what was lost in certain values and what was gained, what was seen, comes back to this idea of this universalist, and of course the great claims made by museums across the world, and especially in the US, I think, but not only, but the great claims made by museums, of course, that even if it was loot, it was better off in their museums because they could look after it and more people could see it. And there was something fundamentally wrong about that. I understood it, and I understood the logic in a certain sense, but there was also something deeply troubling about it. And so I launched into this ridiculous idea of this book, but then to make matters worse, was that I began to feel that you couldn't simply talk about works of art. So that, to take an example, on one day, of course, regardless of how many Iraqis were dying, on one day you'd see some archaic pot being carried off. But on the next day, on page 7, you'd see someone carrying a refrigerator. That was of more value to them. In the immediate sense, they needed the refrigerator. And what were they going to do? Just get into trouble, just too complex to be taking off this urn, hoping that they could get enough money, then they'd have to buy a fridge. Just loot the fridge, So, also, this issue of value became, I think, interwoven with larger issues about, commodities and about, not only who values what, but what's valued by whom at those particular moments of crisis, in which looting, of course, often happens. But the book, to be frank, the book has kind of washed ashore a couple of times, because I remember ending up in the library, but ending up somewhere trying to, when I was staring at Sanskrit, written in the 10th century, thinking to myself, I've made a wrong turn here, because I honestly don't intend to learn Sanskrit now. And, you know, I couldn't just sort of tap on someone's shoulder and say, you're a Sanskrit scholar, can you translate this to me? And so the idea of the historical became a challenge, because I'd been working on, particularly on India, beginning with the partition, in which loot was always, of course, associated with rape and with pillage, as it was called, and burning, destruction. But that had taken me back into earlier Indian histories. So I'm, you know, at the moment I'm writing a series of chapters which really are about the contemporary. I just wrote a rough chapter on Somalia to try and make sense of what was going on in Somalia. Of course, touching with the immediate story of the boats and ships, but then moving into a larger history of value and a history of looting. So I'm in the throes of it. Not all books are like that, thankfully, but this one, it seems to be.
It seems to suggest that we need to begin to think in working in art history in more collaborative ways, because certainly looting in Southeast Asia, in order to look at that within a cultural perspective, really requires collaboration between countries.
Absolutely.
In ways of looking at the politics of that.
Yeah.
And it's not an easy thing to write.
No.
Right. And then, yeah, I mean, it's a perfect case in point, because Thailand, you know, looting, but also, you know, at one point looting was acceptable, something that you did as a practice, and I think anthropologists know this well, you know, there was something accepted, you looted from a tribe, and often, in fact, a shrine was made of a looted object, you know, which was seen as of great value and significance, and you paid homage to that. So this issue of prestige, this issue of it symbolically, in a sense, signifying a relationship between two groups or two communities, was very powerful. You know, I don't want to be a pro-looter, but I do think that historically, you know, looting needs to be seen in a number of different ways.
Have you even considered having a shrine in Indonesia, a shrine to looting?
Hmm?
With a god, then who would the god be?
Interesting. One of you.
I think Saskia at the back first.
Yeah. I have a question. You were mentioning our public organizations, like, for example, Goethe Institute and many others, which were at the place you were. And this in relation to the public, in relation to the audience which is living there but doesn't enter the museum, how do you think do these organizations serve the purpose of the artists or the public there to educate these people, or do these institutions?
How do I see it happening?
Yeah.
Well, quite simply, I do think that you make a massive, you know, educational program in which these exhibitions are embedded, particularly in an environment such as Abu Dhabi or anywhere in the UAE, which, because they haven't had any encounter, you know, any experience of this kind of work, the majority haven't. A handful may have, you know. I do think that there are lots of different ways of doing it, whether you do it through educational programs in the university or whether you do it through outreach in terms of community centres. There are clubs, there are ladies' clubs, for example, in which you have someone, a woman, obviously going to speak to that particular community. you find ways of being able to do it. You know, you spread it in that way, and I think it's done. It's traditionally done like that. You know, they had they have reading groups there, and 10 years ago, about 10 years ago, women, Emirati women began reading groups, and there was about 10 that started, with let's say 7 or 8 participating in each. Now there's over 800, and they read novels. You know, they'll read the most sophisticated and the most challenging in terms of the sorts of values and issues and subjects addressed. They'll read together, and I think, you know, it's a different form. You know, we don't have many. Well, we do have reading groups, but we tend to end up reading, you know, Rancière, and you know, we're not reading novels together. I don't know. Maybe some of you do. Anyway, it's been absolutely, I think, extraordinary in terms of opening these communities up to a sort of wider body of knowledge and understanding, appreciation. And I think you do it the same, in the same sort of manner, in terms of this project. And you organize groups of children, you know, to come to see the exhibition, to be taken through the exhibition, and to appreciate, more than anything, to be able to appreciate visual language and understand that visual language tells you something about the world that no other language does. You know, and this is why we devote our lives to the study, you know, the history of art, because I think all of us implicitly believe, you know, in this, the power of the visual to convey things that otherwise, and that itself, you know, what constitutes the domain of the visual. I had, you know, briefly, a story in which I went to London to see whether to convince or to actually to find an art school that may be best suited to try and set up a branch in Abu Dhabi, because I thought it was very important to do it. And one of the art schools, which remain unnamed, said to me, absolutely cold-faced, said, well, you know, we won't change our curricula. It'll be, you know, the curricula, and, you know, they want to be there partly because of the empowerment, but also financially. And I said, but you'd have to change your curricula. I mean, these are Muslim. You know, it's just, they can't be all going off to life classes, you know, for a start. You know, and the history of art couldn't be just Western. And I'm sure you're just teaching Western. And they said, well, it'll be very difficult for us to change. And I said, well, thank you. You know. So, you know, that's the sort of area that, and again, I mean, I think it's the sort of area that art historians collectively can begin to, you know, intervene on and provide, you know, the sort of expertise that you have.
We have final 2 questions, Reem and then Mary. Okay.
Charles, thank you so much for the talk. It was very enlightening, as usual. Well, if I understood you correctly, and basically just like this idea of like big institutions and museums in particular, like the Louvre and the Guggenheim, going into a place like Abu Dhabi with all the specificities of that place, I mean, and we putting into consideration the fact that these are museums that were built at a point where there was definitely a colonial heritage to their actual manifestation. And if you want this whole national, let's say, pivotal making of like the defining moment of those like national institutions, and they are being, you know, transported in a way into another place and in a different context. And if I understood you correctly, I think you were in a way trying to decolonize them. In a, you know, like there was an attempt, if that's how I read you correctly, to sort of also invite them to not just revisit, but also sort of, you know, flip it over and use that as a pretext or as an opportunity to be able to do that. And I find it quite fascinating that you're saying that there was no basically, even locally, there was no impetus to actually see that opportunity, if I understood you correctly. Like, even locally within Abu Dhabi, you're saying that there was no initiative that could actually foster that, let's say, claim or attempt to be able to do that. And also, coming from the Louvre and Guggenheim, there was no also initiative in that kind of direction. And I have another question, like in like the other side. Why not, like?
Can we answer that one first?
No.
The second one.
So organically.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting opportunity, right?
Yeah.
But like, why not also like, you know, like the just the usual organic sort of growth within a country that has already, you know, really needs a sort of natural process to be able to also, you know, create something for its own. I mean, Abu Dhabi and Dubai are exploding with buildings that are just, you know, the projects with 90 tower buildings, like skyscrapers, you know, the rifting of land, the fact that they just built up in less than 10 years of time. I mean, wouldn't it have been more like natural to actually, you know, let's say preach more like organic growth of institutions there that have their own character and...
I agree in principle, but, you know, rich Emiratis drive down the freeway at about 180. So, you know, they have no time to spend as far as they're concerned. They want to be a part of the club quickly. They have a sense of imperative. I mean, aside from that, but they have a sense of imperative, which I think is driven prior to, you know, a few moments ago, imperative to be able to actually use their wealth and diversify it in terms of investment. And as we know, you know, they've invested a lot here in the States. But that surplus, particularly in terms of two or three families, has also been seen as an opportunity to invest in the cultural. And they don't...
If you want, the Sharjah Biennale in particular, and the fact that it took them like 8 years, but in a way it was, you know, it took them a process, but they did try to build something that was articulate for the own space, and it did take a form that is international per se. But
no, I agree with you. But remember also that Abu Dhabi sees itself as the capital. You know, those families that rule Abu Dhabi sees themselves and want to be seen as the capital. So they don't want to do just something like Sharjah. They don't want that sort of model. I mean, it has a biennale, whatever biennales are, as far as they're concerned. Dubai is Dubai. Commercial centre, galleries, very good, etc. But Abu Dhabi does see itself as the capital. But at the same time, when I came on board, and it was very subtle, but it's very clear that it happened. When I came on board, principally the cultural district of Sadiyat was seen as a tourist resort, as an adjunct to the hotel development and the golf course and, you know, leisure and recreation, da-da-da. So it was just seen as an adjunct there, or as an additional part of recreation and leisure. When I came, there was this wonderful chart, I wish I had it still, which showed, you know, under this development company that was set up by the government, it showed non-commercial, in terms of the overall budget, non-commercial use, land use, and expenditure was 10% of the overall for Sadiyat. And that expanded, I mean, that, you know, last year we were spending $1 million a day. And so it just completely changed. in terms of the kind of economics that were involved in building this, but in such a way that, you know, it, in a sense, it rose in symbolic value. As it rose in economic cost, it rose also in symbolic value. This is the amount that we need to pay, you know, to do this. Obviously, you know, symbolic value there, therefore, is greater. But it doesn't quite, I mean, I guess that doesn't quite answer your question. But I do think that they seized it as an opportunity with which to promote Abu Dhabi as a symbolic, you know, symbolically as the capital of the UAE, if not, you know, of the region in terms of the Gulf. The other question, the earlier question, is I wasn't quite saying that they're not aware. I think that they're very aware. I think the efforts to, on the part of the French and of the people involved, I think for some of them it is a genuine effort to go beyond colonial, post-colonial, to establish a different kind of relation. But it's a government organization. And you or me or anyone here may, you know, believe that and work in good faith towards that and be able to accomplish something. But I actually think that the leadership think slightly differently, you know, and that it becomes part of the French state, of the project of the French state in the region. And I think, you know, Sarkozy's all about that. Hence, you know, he's meddling with whatever issues in terms of his leadership of the EU. So I think that, you know, it's possible to be able to say, yes, some of the curators are actually working in good faith to be able to be beyond this, but they don't quite know how. And I understand. I think it's very complex. And so they grasp at something. And I think, unfortunately, you know, this idea of a universal museum is something that is kind of appealing and is sufficient, has become sufficient, but highly problematic. And the sorts of discussions that I thought we should have were discussions that were constantly curtailed by the exigencies of, you know, what had to be done. So I don't know whether, you know, it answers sufficiently. I don't think it was ever thought by the Abu Dhabi leadership of the slow process. It's just not how they, it's just not in their blood.
Well, hopefully some of those discussions will continue over here, and I think this is a good point. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.